Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast was co-hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group and its Religious Liberties Practice Group. It was recorded on Wednesday, June 26, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's telephone conference call. On today's call, we're going to be discussing the Supreme Court's decisions in today's cases decided by the Supreme Court, the Prop 8 case, Hollingsworth versus Perry, and the Defense of Marriage case, Defense of Marriage Act case, United States versus Windsor. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and as always, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. I'm pleased to welcome to our call today two experts, Carrie Severino and Professor Jonathan Adler, both returning guests to our Teleform conference call series. Their bios are available on our website, so for now, let me just orient you by telling you that Carrie Severino is Chief Counsel and Policy Director to the Judicial Crisis Network, where she follows the court carefully. She's also a former clerk for Judge David Sentell and Justice Clarence Thomas. Jonathan Adler is a professor at Case Western University Law School, where he teaches constitutional, administrative, and environmental law. He's also a David Sentell clerk. We're going to hear opening remarks from each, first on the DOMA case and then on the Prop 8 case. We'll hear from Carrie Severino first. She's going to give us about 8 to 10 minutes, including background on the case. Then we'll hear Jonathan Adler on DOMA. Then we'll go back to Carrie Severino on Prop 8, and then Jonathan Adler on Prop 8. And then we'll get to your questions. I can tell you now we've got what looks like a growing list, but perhaps a record number of participants in today's call. So let's get right to the discussion. Carrie Severino, your opening remarks on the DOMA case.
Thanks so much, Dean. I want to just start by giving a quick summary of the case, because the facts of the case, well, probably they'll be familiar to a lot of people, are worth reviewing and are relevant to the holding and to some of the details of how it came down. So this, we're starting with the case of U.S. versus Windsor. This is a case involved coming out of New York State involving two women who were married in Canada in a marriage that was legal in Canada at the time. Then they moved to New York, where same-sex marriage is now legal. And Edith Windsor's partner died, Thea Spire, and she left her estate to Edith in her will. Now, if they had been married, if they were married under New York law, that they wanted it to be their estate to pass to Windsor under federal law for the sake of federal taxes. So, if this was just a gift between two unmarried individuals, there would be a estate tax involved. Whereas, if this was passing from one spouse to another under federal law, about approximately $300,000 worth of taxes here would have been avoided. So that's why Windsor is feeling aggrieved by the Defense of Marriage Act in this case. The key provision of the Defense of Marriage Act is the one that defines for federal law, the purposes of federal law, the meaning of marriage. So there's two provisions. One, it talks about full faith and credit clause and whether states have to recognize each other's marriages. That's not at issue here. It's really just the definition of marriage under federal law, including, it's for the purposes of the state, federal estate tax law, but it also would include a whole range of federal benefits in the way military couples were treated, and Medicaid, or you name it. There's a lot of places in federal law where marriage is defined. So DOMA says, it was passed in the wake of states just starting to think about legalizing same-sex marriage. And the reasoning behind passing it was sort of at issue in this case. It was either to nationalize one definition so that all the states had the same definition, at least for the purposes of federal law, or, as the majority in this case alleges, to purposely discriminate against a group of people. And that's a real fundamental difference between the majority and the dissent in these cases. So I'll move into now what the majority opinion held. Well, actually, let me quick go into one other aspect of the case, which is how it was brought up, because this is important, that Windsor sued to not have to pay that $300,000, and when she first brought the lawsuit, the federal government was opposed to her, defending the statute, defending DOMA. They said, no, you still have to do this, money is due to us. The federal government rather famously changed course and in its defense of DOMA and decided it did not want to defend DOMA any further. And so by the time her case was appealed to the Second Circuit and then to the Supreme Court, the federal government was now agreeing with Edith Windsor that it did not owe her the money. It still hadn't paid her back that $300,000 she was forced to pay, but it agreed that they didn't have to, that DOMA was unconstitutional. In fact, one of the case makes a big deal of if the motion to dismiss, which explicitly asked them not to dismiss the case because the federal government agreed with Edith Windsor. So there was a standing question whether it was actually a controversy here in the first place if you've got parties on both sides of the case that agree. So because the federal government, in the form of the Department of Justice, wasn't defending this case, Congress stepped in to defend it. The Bipartisan Legal Advisory Group was created by the House in order to defend the law in the absence of executive branch defense, and that group appointed Paul Clement to bring these defenses throughout the country whenever DOMA was challenged, but the federal government was refusing to defend it. So there's sort of three parties involved in this case, Windsor, and then who is the woman who wants to receive her estate tax refund on this case, the federal government, which is technically opposed to her but agrees with her, and then the Bipartisan Legal Advisory Group, which is actually defending the statute. So Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion of the court, and in that opinion, he finds that there is standing to bring the lawsuit, and in light of that, decides on a sort of hybrid rationale that is sort of part federalism, part equal protection arguments. He talks about the fact that the federal government can make some definitions regarding the meaning of marriage for the purposes of federal law, but that the states have the traditional interest in role in defining and regulating marriage. He quotes Lawrence versus Texas and talks about the state's interest in private consensual intimacy as part of an element in a personal bond that's more enduring. He likes going and quoting his own language there. And then he also points to two different ways in which that gets brought in to the Equal Protection Clause. He says once a state has defined something as marriage, the federal government can't single out one type of lawful marriage as lesser than another. So setting aside the fact that DOMA was actually passed before any states had a lawful same-sex marriage, he said that they're creating two contradictory marriage regimes within the same state. And he said that the states are allowed to confer this dignity as an exercise of their sovereign power. So these are federalist-sounding kind of terms that he uses. But he also talks about it in terms of Equal Protection Clause-type language. He waxes eloquent about the importance of same-sex marriages in the importance to the tens of thousands of children who are being raised by same-sex couples. He talks about the disapproval of the class and concludes, really from my perspective, a selective reading of legislative history, that the avowed purpose and practical effect of the law here are to impose a disadvantage, create a separate second-class status, and a stigma on everyone in same-sex marriages. Now, I think legislative history contains a lot of different things in it, which is why it inevitably becomes a selective type reading. But then by his conclusion, he goes back and starts sounding more like he's resting this on a federalism grounds. He talks about these are same-sex marriages made lawful by the state and deemed by the state entitled to recognition and protection, and then the state finds that to be dignified and proper, and now we're injuring people who the state, by its marriage laws, sought to protect in personhood and dignity, and it's confining its holding to those lawful marriages. So it's kind of a mix of this federalism and equal protection type argument. The Chief Justice dissented and wrote his own dissent, chiefly pointing out the limits on this decision, particularly the fact that it doesn't purport to overturn, go farther than just overturning DOMA on these federalist type grounds, and it doesn't have before it the entire broad sweep of every other law in the states in the country. Justice Scalia issues an even more biting than normal dissent, arguing with Chief Justice joined as well as did Justice Thomas and Justice Alito, that there was no standing to bring the case here, and he talks about the essential nature of having a controversy when you have a case in controversy as required for Article III standing, and really criticizes the majority opinion for really relegating standing to almost a prudential question, when in fact standing is such a fundamental constitutional question that a court can even raise it sua sponte, even if the litigants don't raise it. That's something that the court raises themselves. So he's very critical that they've made that almost a prudential matter when it really should be a mandatory question because it goes to the constitutional right. And I'll just quickly read Justice Scalia's intro to his thing because this summarizes his dissent, which is that this case is about power. It's about the power of our people to govern themselves and the power of the court to pronounce the law. And today's opinion aggrandizes the latter, the power of the court, with a predictable consequence of diminishing the former. So it's about diminishing the power of the people to govern themselves while the court is aggregating that power to itself. I'll point out, though, at least that this does leave the power to a certain extent in the hands of the people of the individual states, at least for now. But there's really the writing on the wall with this equal protection clause language that the court may choose to take this one step further in the next case.
All righty. Well, first, it's a pleasure to be here. Let me just make a few comments about Windsor. Let me also just, I guess as a matter of disclosure, I participated in an amicus brief of law professors urging the court to consider federalism issues in analyzing DOMA and arguing that there would not be a sufficient federal interest to justify DOMA, but taking no position on Perry or what interest states might have. I don't know whether or not our brief was influential or not, but certainly pleased to see as much discussion of federalism as there was in Kennedy's opinion, although I should note that this is a very Kennedy opinion. There's no the analysis is sweeping and vague. It's like a lot of Kennedy opinions. It's the sort of thing that as a law professor, you hope never to see from a student, because what you want from a student is a very clear identification of what's the question, what's the rule, apply the rule. We don't get any of that. We don't get, for example, any identification of what level of scrutiny is to be applied, whether we're talking about determinations based on sexual preference or even distinctions in the context of marriage, and the opinion almost goes out of its way to avoid the sort of buzzwords that would give a clue as to how to fit this into our traditional doctrinal categories. And we've seen this before. Justice Kennedy's opinion in Lawrence has a very similar quality of a lot of sweeping language, but when you finish the opinion, you're left without any clear direction as whether or not it was rational basis or some form of heightened scrutiny. In terms of the nature of the holding, I think it's quite limited, and almost as limited as it could be, given the court's conclusion that DOMA was struck down. The court, Kennedy stressed that the federal interest in defining marriage as such is really quite limited. He notes that there are special cases in which a federal definition of marriage might be necessary to further a very clear federal interest. And so one example that is noted is in immigration law, where a marriage that is recognized by a state but that the federal government believes was entered into fraudulently does not have to be recognized for purposes of immigration the federal government does not have to acknowledge it and allow that marriage to alter someone's immigration status. So the court notes that in those sorts of narrow instances, you could have a sufficient interest. But what's different here is here Congress sought to redefine the definition of marriage and of a spouse for some 1,000 or so statutes across the board all at once, and the unifying federal interest in that really was defending marriage as it has traditionally been known, and in Kennedy's view, in the majority's view, that's not something that the federal government has an interest in, and I think that is certainly significant, and it is notable that the court does, or Kennedy does, repeatedly come back to these federalist notions. On the jurisdictional point, what's really interesting here in terms of the jurisdictional question in the case is that it's a very close case whether or not the court had jurisdiction, whether or not Blagg had a standing in this case. Six justices ultimately conclude that there was jurisdiction. In addition to the majority, Justice Alito also believed that jurisdiction should be found here. And Justice Alito also notes that it's odd that the court found jurisdiction in this case, but as we'll talk about in a minute, found that there was no jurisdiction in the Proposition 8 case because jurisdiction is tougher in Windsor than in Prop 8. And he suggests that if jurisdiction was only to have been found in one of the cases, it probably should have been the reverse. And I think he's right on that, although I do believe the court did have jurisdiction in both cases. Something else that I just have to note in Justice Alito's dissent, everyone should take a look at footnote 7 if for no other reason than Justice Alito, his somewhat arch dismissal of the way the trial court had purported to make findings of fact about what are really some broad philosophical questions about the nature of marriage and the nature of the family. And he concludes with I think, a well-deserved swipe at many of my colleagues at the Academy for suggesting that the Supreme Court was somehow bound by these conclusions that Judge Walker had characterized as findings of fact, and ends the footnote with the line, "Only an arrogant legal culture that has lost all appreciation of its own limitations could take such a suggestion seriously." So I got quite a chuckle out of that. Last point I wanted to make is that there are some things that the court did not decide that we will see litigation on almost right away. One is the other part of the Defense of Marriage Act, the part that allows states to not extend full faith and credit to same-sex marriages performed in other states. So a state like Ohio, in which I reside, where there's a constitutional amendment limiting marriage to a union of a man and a woman, Ohio does not have to recognize a same-sex marriage performed lawfully in, say, New York or District of Columbia. So that was not an issue here. Also, the majority never addresses the question of what would happen if a couple is lawfully married in one state, moves to a state that does not recognize same-sex marriage. Would the federal government be allowed to say, the state in which you are domiciled doesn't recognize the marriage, so we do not, or would the federal recognition of the marriage kind of attach at the moment of marriage and forever follow that couple? I would be inclined to say that the latter result is more likely the eventual result, but the court never addresses that point, even after Justice Scalia in dissent notes that this is one of the questions that its resolution of the case leaves open. And I will stop there.
Kerry Severino, you want to walk us through the Prop 8 case?
Sure. Proposition 8 is the case coming out of California. In that state, there was actually two different attempts to make the marriage just between a man and a woman in the state. First, there was a proposition that went through that as a matter of law, simply said as a matter of law, they have all of these benefits, but it's not going to be called marriage. That was ultimately struck down by the California Supreme Court that said, the California Equal Protection Clause in its own constitution requires marriage between a man, requires that the definition not be limited to marriage between a man and a woman. So while that case was even going through the courts, there was a group trying to then work through Proposition 8, which would have amended the California Constitution itself to make marriage just between a man and a woman. In that proposition, just a matter of months after the court determined that the California Constitution required marriage to be extended to same-sex couples, Proposition 8 went through, which then amended the Constitution to effectively overturn that Supreme Court decision, the California Supreme Court decision. Then the case went through the California District Court, the Federal District Court, and they were trying to claim that this was a equal protection violation under the federal constitution. So that's the case that we have here today. Now, the district court, in a very famous decision, determined that The Equal Protection Clause does require marriage to be extended to same-sex couples. That was Judge John Walker's decision, and there were a lot of criticisms of the way he ran the trial. But it was, nonetheless, the final ruling there, and then that was appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court. Now, what's interesting is that at the district court level, the governor and the attorney general of California were the ones who were technically defending this case. But much like the DOMA decision, they determined that they did not want to defend Proposition 8's constitutionality. The governor himself took no position on the issue, but the attorney general claimed it was unconstitutional. So he was in exactly the position that the Obama administration was in Windsor. So in that case, instead of having the bipartisan legal advisory group intervene, there was a group of Proposition 8 proponents who intervened, and they're the ones who effectively were defending the law during the 12-day trial and during the district court level of that case. Then at the appellate level, the governor and attorney general declined to appeal the case, but the Proposition 8 defenders wanted to continue the case up to the Ninth Circuit. When the Ninth Circuit got the case, they were concerned about standing issues, so they certified a question to the California Supreme Court asking whether in the absence of the governor or the attorney general defending this case, whether these proponents of the initiative could do so. And the California Supreme Court issued a ruling that is what this case turns on effectively, and that is they said that when you have a post-election challenge to a voter-approved initiative measure, the official proponents of the initiative are authorized under California law to appear and assert the state's interest in the initiative's validity and appeal a judgment invalidating the measure when the public officials who ordinarily defend the measure or appeal such a judgment decline to do so. So as a matter of California law, and I believe they found this as a matter of the California Constitution as well as the California Election Code, the initiative proponents are authorized to bring this case. So then the Ninth Circuit found that it did violate the Equal Protection Clause under a much narrower theory than the district court did, and that a decision was appealed to the Supreme Court. This one was disposed of on standing grounds, and this was a decision by the Chief Justice, joined by the liberal members of the court, with Justice Kennedy writing the dissent, joined by Justice Scalia, Justice Thomas, and Justice Alito. And as I said, this case ultimately did end up turning on standing. Article 3 standing requires the litigant to prove that they have a concrete and particularized injury that's traceable to the challenged conduct and likely to be redressed by a favorable judicial decision. So this court is focused on the lack of particularized injury to the parties here. They said, look, these proponents may be deeply committed to upholding Proposition 8, but they have no direct stake in the appeal and only the same generalized grievance that any other citizen would have. The proponents, which Kennedy's dissent agreed with, claimed they have a unique interest because the state does not have to show a particularized interest. The state has its own interest in defending the laws. And in this case, the California law gave to the proponents of Proposition 8, effectively accorded to them that interest. That was the line that the California Supreme Court took, and that was the argument that was accepted by the Kennedy dissent. The majority opinion, on the other hand, claimed that this right given them to them by the California Supreme Court only gives them the right to go to the court and make arguments, but it doesn't make them de facto public officials or agents of the state. He talks a lot about the rule of agency and how they couldn't be agents because they're not authorized to do so. And they're not formal agents. They're not de facto agents of the state, and therefore that they can't aid in this litigation. He said there are cases that we've allowed third parties to litigate on behalf of the state, but they have to have a direct interest in these or direct injury involved, and these people do not have an actual injury in the case. So based on that, the Chief Justice, along with Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Kagan and Sotomayor claimed that there was no standing in this case to bring the appeal. You know, really, it was only the appeal that was at issue here, and so the presumption, I guess, is that this goes back to the district court and that decision would stand. The curious thing is that the district court decision stands on, first of all, a equal protection theory that no other court has gone as far as that in stating in terms of requiring same-sex marriage. Second of all, it's complicated in that it's not clear whether there would have been standing at the district court, given the governor and the attorney general's unwillingness to defend the law at that point. That kind of intersects with Windsor in terms of the way that the federal government was on the same side. There's not this controversy going on, but in that case, you have them just laying down their arms and refusing to bring the case, as opposed to trying to continue a case that they've already won. Sort of the flip side. There's also the question of what the breadth of application of this decision is, because it was only in the Northern District of California that the case, that the district court opinion would hold. Can this be applied elsewhere in the state when the Ninth Circuit decision has been vacated? That's a serious question in of itself. And just to comment a little bit from Kennedy's dissent, he, again, adopts the California Supreme Court's analysis, and he also talks a lot about how this undermines the initiative process, because it would require the governor and the attorney general to cooperate in defending a law or a constitutional amendment passed by initiative, where, as he said, the very purpose of the initiative process is to have access to government when you feel that your governor and or other elected officials are not affecting the will of the people. So the people have a direct access to government rather than having to go through their elected officials. He says, the essence of democracy is that the right to make law rests in the people and flows to the government, not the other way around, that freedom resides first in the people without need for a grant for government. So he criticizes the idea that they would need to have a specific grant from the government to be able to defend this initiative when, in fact, the California Supreme Court has given them that authority. So I'll turn it over to Jonathan to talk further about this case.
Sure. The Perry case, certainly the lineup is a bit odd. We have, as Carrie noted, the Chief Justice joined by Scalia, Ginsburg, Kagan, and Breyer finding no standing, and a divided decision on standing in which Ginsburg, Kagan, and Breyer all believe that there isn't standing when other justices think there is something quite odd and unusual. It's also a bit odd in this case because, as I noted, I think most observers would have assumed that the jurisdictional question was closer and more difficult in Windsor than it was here. And that's because, as a general matter, the sorts of interests that can support Article III standing are often a function of state law. Certainly, if we're thinking about property interests, the infringement of which can be an injury for Article III purposes, the court has made clear that it looks to property as defined by state law. And if we're talking about a right that is integral to the structure of a state's government and the operations of a state government, one would think that the state's understanding of how the state allows its citizens to vindicate their interests through a referendum process and the like would satisfy federal courts for standing purposes. And it's a bit odd for federal courts to impose a particular procedural requirement or a particular type of agency relationship in order for a state to determine standing. But the practical result of this decision, combined with Windsor, is to leave the question of same-sex marriage in the states. As Carrie noted, there are some real questions about what happens to Judge Walker's ruling at the trial court and the scope of its mandate. Typically, district courts do not have or the mandate of a district court opinion does not apply to those who are not parties to the case. Although the parties in the litigation certainly wanted a statewide mandate, we don't usually think of a district court mandate as having that sort of effect. And so that will certainly have to be dealt with more broadly. I think the broader implication of this opinion, again, as Carrie noted, is that it really creates a very interesting situation for the two dozen or so states that have referendum processes provided for in their state constitutions, because the whole point of those processes is to give citizens the ability to control and discipline elected representatives. And if citizens believe that the legislature or the state executive is not faithfully following the wishes of the citizens. It provides a means for citizens to directly either see legislation enacted or, as in the case is in many states, to directly amend the state constitution. It would seem one possible consequence of the majority opinion is that state officials will be able to frustrate these efforts in many states across a wide range of issues by simply refusing to defend challenges to these to referenda and initiatives in federal court. And that would really be an odd result, and certainly could have a significant impact on quite a few states. Now, one last point I'll make, because I'm sure it would otherwise come up in the questions, is what do we make of this odd lineup? Only three justices would have found standing in both cases, Kennedy, Alito, and Sotomayor. And Justices Scalia and Roberts would have found standing in neither case. The remaining justices, Thomas, Breyer, Kagan, and Ginsburg, split on where they found standing. And so one bit of speculation that we're going to, I'm sure, see for quite some time is whether or not any of the standing votes were strategic. In particular, whether or not any of the justices that voted against standing in Perry did so because they were afraid of the result. There'll be some time before we know, but I will just underline again the anomaly of Justices Breyer, Kagan, and Ginsburg, justices that already define standing in almost any conceivable circumstance, voting against standing here, even when a state Supreme Court had unanimously held that the requirements or the necessary interests for standing under state law would have been met. And I think that certainly leads to the suspicion that had this case gone to the merits, Justice Kennedy was not ready, at least at this point in time, to declare that the Constitution requires states to recognize same-sex marriage. If so, it will certainly be interesting to see how this court deals with what are the inevitable follow-on cases when litigants challenge Section 2 of DOMA or challenge other state provisions directly.
Thank you. That was Jonathan Adler. Carrie Severino, before we go to audience questions, do you want to respond or rebut, or should we go right to the audience now?
Just one quick response to kind of pair up the two cases. I think the bottom line here is that we don't see that same-sex marriage advocates were hoping they would get the justices to imposing a national definition of marriage. We don't get that. Even in the case of DOMA, it still rely somewhat on the states. And the second interesting point is that we are seeing something we wouldn't have seen 30 years ago, hard to imagine, that such a contentious policy issue is being decided on federalism grounds. So that's, I guess, maybe is my silver lining on this. The question is, to me, is that Jonathan kind of hinted at when he talked about what happens when you move from one state to another is there's language in this decision that says we don't want to have two different regimes in the Windsor decision, that is, two different regimes within a state, and it's noxious that the federal government would be trying to create that. But we have a potential of doing exactly that if, as I fear may happen, we have just fair-weather federalists on the court, where in this decision they're willing to look at the state law. But the next case where, say, you have someone who gets married in New York and moves to North Carolina, now what happens with their estate? Now what happens with their federal benefits? I think you could easily see those two regimes being reenacted just with the federal government carrying on the benefits. You could have New York become the new Las Vegas. Everyone goes there to get married, and then you can transfer those benefits throughout the country. So, I'm heartened to see some, at least lip service, hopefully more than that, being paid to federalism. I just hope it's something that will be enduring and not just a convenient way of limiting the decision today, when a lot of language in Kennedy's opinion points to the lack of rational basis that he sees for traditional a definition of marriage, which really is the death knell for that under equal protection analysis whenever he gets the case before him where he's willing to do that. I'm not sure whether that's a matter of poll numbers or a certain amount of time that will have to elapse before he would want to extend his analysis there.
All right, let's check in with the audience. In a moment, we're all going to hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we turn to the audience, let me make a programming announcement. Yesterday, of course, we hosted a teleforum call that split its attention between the recently decided Fisher case and the Shelby County case. Tomorrow at noon, we're going to take a much closer look at the Shelby County case. That's the Voting Rights Act Amendment case with renowned scholar Abigail Thernstrom. That call is tomorrow at noon Eastern time. So do mark your calendars and look for an email. It's quite likely we'll add a conference call on Friday. And, of course, check in with our website for a schedule of calls for the coming week. We've got quite a few people on the call today, at least a handful of whom have questions. So let's go to our first call.
Hello, this is Michael Rossman with the Center for Individual Rights. And I have a question about Justice Scalia's understanding of Article 3. And correct me if I'm wrong, he seems to include an element of adverseness in his Windsor opinion as an underlying requirement of Article 3, yet at the same time, at least implicitly in Perry, because he didn't write separately, and I think pretty explicitly in Windsor, he suggests that the district courts had jurisdiction over the original suit, but that there wasn't appellate jurisdiction going up the line. I'm trying to understand how these two ideas can be reconciled, and I was hoping the panel could help me.
Well, this is Carrie. So in terms of the Windsor case, the jurisdiction at the district court level, it's a little easier because at least at the initial stage of the case, the government was on the other side, and they did, while they weren't arguing in favor of a constitutionality of DOMA, she still had the injury of not having this $300,000 the government was still withholding. So they were unwilling.
But that was true up and down the line, though, wasn't it? Wasn't that true up and down the line? I mean, they
sure,
continued
to
withhold
it.
Sure,
but I guess what Scalia would say is they had to, once they get a judgment, then you owe the money. Then you're done. Now they were saying, well, we don't think it's constitutional, but we don't want to pay. And the court says you have to pay, and now you have to pay. You don't get to just keep on appealing it, saying the same thing. It's a little bit more perplexing, but it seems a little simpler that the question when you need to say it, we don't really think we need to do it, but we want at least a court to say it. So there's they're wanting to have a court decision to prove that you have to pay versus wanting to have a Supreme Court decision instead of a district court is a little different. I don't know if Jonathan can explain better what the
This is something that it is interesting. You know, Scalia notes this, but in his opinion, but he doesn't rely upon the standard citations and authorities for this claim, because traditionally the court's Article III standing decisions have not focused on adverseness as being part of what Article III requires. Rather, it has been an explanation for why a party must have standing in the first place to bring suit. I have a little bit of puzzlement on his emphasis on that there, and I actually am inclined to think that the way Justice Kennedy addresses this by pointing out that adverseness, as described by Scalia, is really more an element of prudential standing than it is of Article III standing. I think that is true. I also think, and the court has accepted certain, at least one case next term that may get into this a little more, that prudential standing itself is not jurisdictional the way that Article III standing is. The court also refutes certain some cases that would clarify that. But I think from that standpoint, that's one way to understand why the court would
think
of it.
Well, I understand that people disagreed with Scalia. I'm just trying to understand why wouldn't, if you believe in adverseness as a part of Article III, wouldn't you just say that in both instances there was no subject matter jurisdiction in the district court?
Well, or at least no jurisdiction beyond the ability to enter a default judgment. So certainly no, I think a conclusion there would have to be that there was no jurisdiction beyond no jurisdiction to issue any kind of opinion that has any force other than the entering of a default judgment. I do think that would be an implication of that. There might be a timing question. If I recall correctly, Edith Windsor may have filed her suit initially before the administration announced its current position, and so that might have at least saved the trial court proceedings. But I would have to double check on that timing point.
I think that is correct, that they initially were defending it and then changed midway. But I think it was clearly before the motion to dismiss stage, because if they moved not to dismiss.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And I have a quick question. I'm a little troubled about what seems to be now the state's ability to define terms for its citizens to receive federal benefits. Do you see that as an avenue for abuse? Is a cash-strapped state going to define some term in a federal statute to expand the number of citizens that can receive some other kind of benefit, whether it's a disability definition or any other kind of definition? Is there an opportunity?
I wouldn't think so. And I think the opinion notes that there are certain legal concepts and legal statuses that in our tradition are, you know, grow out of the common law and therefore are the peculiar province of state law. And that would, you know, that argument can be made with regard to marriage, which, you know, pre-exists the existence of our Constitution. It can also be made with regard to, for example, what constitutes property in many circumstances and other things. But for something like disability or some term that is really a function of federal, or, you know, that's merely a function of a federal statute, I don't think that the states would have that kind of leeway, and I don't think this opinion would entail that.
Right, disability, not, but I can imagine circumstances in which definitions of certain types of property could start to run into issues there, but I agree. You'd have to have something with a solid history of states being the deciding factor in that kind of law, which does limit it at least.
All right, let's take another question. Again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Ben Pugh from Orange County, California. I just wanted to point out a fun little dispute that's probably going to pop up out here in California. California has a constitutional provision, Article 3, Section 3.5, that prevents any administrative agency from failing to enforce the California Constitution unless told, you know, on the basis of finding that the California Constitution's violates the Constitution, either its Constitution or the federal Constitution, unless such a ruling comes from an appellate court. Right now, we only have Vaughn Walker's decision now after the Supreme Court. So Jerry Brown is busy ordering every county to start issuing marriage licenses, but I have a feeling that there are going to be some red counties out here that are going to resist that, and they might cite Article 3, Section 3.5. So we might get this teed up again, with a county that can actually serve with legitimate standing. I'm not sure which county is going to want to take on that burden, but it's certainly possible. So I just wanted to alert everybody to that it's really not over, hopefully. But I guess with Scalia's dissent and the writings on the wall, if this gets up to Kennedy again, I think he's just letting it baste a little bit and marinate, and then he's going to pull the hammer down probably next term, I guess, with Scalia's prediction.
If I could just add one point, think that's one thing that's certainly interesting and some other folks have commented on, is that the original plaintiffs in the Perry case really went to a lot of effort to keep parties out that might have had standing to defend Prop 8. As I recall, there was a clerk that sought to intervene on the grounds that they would be impacted if they had to issue a marriage license that they felt was contrary to their oath because of Proposition 8, and they had fought that. And you know, a consequence of those efforts by the plaintiff's attorneys in this litigation is that there ended up not being jurisdiction in the Supreme Court to issue the definitive ruling on the merits that the plaintiffs claimed that they were seeking.
It maybe follows like the ICE agent's lawsuit against Obama's deference or refusal to enforce the immigration law, that they have the right to actually enforce immigration law despite Obama's policy statement that he's not going to. They have standing, apparently, according to one federal trial court.
Right, although I would note in terms of the scenario you sketched out, my guess is that would really initially come up in a state law context, and it would be a question of state law whether or not the governor's orders are valid, although I could certainly imagine parallel federal proceedings just on the question of whether or not Judge Walker's original mandate is binding beyond the precise parties, and insofar as it's binding on state officials, whether it affects them going forward in the context of other marriage applications.
Actually, just to add, I'm not sure. It might not be as hard as you predicted to find a plaintiff, because I think you wouldn't have to have the county government. It would seem to me that any county clerk or even some of the lower-level officials that were required to do it may be valid parties, as you pointed out. So there might be a larger selection group to find to bring this state and or eventually maybe a federal suit questioning the extent of Judge Walker's ruling.
And I'll just make one more point before leaving the floor. I voted for Prop 8, and Judge Walker adjudicated that I'm a bigot. Have I been harmed? Can't I sue and say, no, I'm not. I didn't vote for an animus. Justice Kennedy called me a bigot. He said the only reason I possibly, well, essentially, in the DOMA decision, but you can see the writing on the wall again, that the only reason anybody could possibly differentiate between marriage between a man and a woman and marriage between gays is they're a bigot. Is that stigma that is now associated with me of a similar stigma that has been associated or that Judge Kennedy found was such a terrible burden and harm that violated or that made rendered DOMA unconstitutional? I would think I should have standing to complain that, you know, no, I'm not a bigot and I want this stigma removed from me.
I think it's maybe a generalized stigma, in which case. You don't have standing. Go on, Jonathan.
Yeah, I also don't think that Kennedy's opinion really, really takes that step. I mean, in both the beginning and the end of the opinion, he makes very clear that the question is how the federal government treats a status that a state has recognized. And I think goes out of its way to make clear that the court is saying nothing about civil unions, saying nothing about the refusal to recognize same-sex marriage in the first place, and that the question is what legitimate federal interest could the federal government have when presented with two marriages that both are of the same legal consequence as far as state law is concerned? What basis could the federal government have in distinguishing between the two? And while acknowledging that there might be special cases in which there is a federal interest, like the immigration example I gave before, that the mere desire to defend a traditional definition of marriage, while which may be perfectly reasonable at the state level, given the nature of state police powers and the traditional state role in domestic relations, is just not something that is federally cognizable. You know, again, I would participate in a brief that made that argument. I think that's correct. I also would readily admit that it has more radical implications for some other assertions of federal power than perhaps some of the justices that joined Kennedy's opinion may want to acknowledge. But I think it is fair to say, we can say that there are things that are cognizable and weighty interests to a state that are not weighty interests to the federal government. And, you know, I think that's for those of us that are concerned about the growth of federal power, that's a really positive thing to take out of this opinion, whatever our views of same-sex marriage are.
Yeah, I agree with Jonathan. I hope that they continue to make those distinctions. I'm just concerned seeing some of the language, because obviously we know from Justice Kennedy's history and citing to Romer that in his mind, determining that something has a bigoted or discriminatory rationale to it is a death knell for, and he seems to have suggested that if there is really no federal rationale here, he is dismissing quite a few arguments that were made offering a federal rationale. The federal government has no interest in uniformity, no interest in really even protecting the how much money it's spending on these different things and things like that. So that is one undercuts a lot of potential state arguments. He also, when he characterizes the state's interest, seems to be going back to his own conception of this personal bond and sort of his poetic arguments about the importance of relationships, rather than the fundamental questions that I think would be the ones that are more likely to carry the day in terms of a state interest, which have to do with the fundamental nature of the family and of the marital union. And when you've ignored those arguments, then it's very hard to it's harder at least to articulate the state interest. That said, I do still think it's a good thing that we're leaving it to the states, at least, and hopefully leaving it to the people and their elected representatives rather than imposing from above a federal definition in this case.
Let's take another question.
Hi, my name is Larry White. I work with veterans groups, particularly those going through divorces. What do you think the impact of this decision might be on other federal laws affecting marriage?
Can you give an example what you're thinking of?
Specifically, the Uniform Services Former Spouses Protection Act, 10 U.S.C. 1408.
I will admit right off the bat, I'm not terribly familiar with the operation of that law, but my general view is that I don't think this opinion will have much effect beyond eliminating any part of a law that defines marriage as only being between a man and a woman, or defining spouse as having to be of the opposite sex. I think other things that we see, like for tax purposes, when a divorce becomes effective for purposes of tax status and things like that, I would think are unaffected.
Thank you.
It does seem as if that would have a real impact on a law like that. I'm sure that seems like one of the kinds of laws that uses the term spouse that's included in this decision today. There's 1,100 different laws apparently that use the terms marriage or spouse. So all of those would then include same-sex spouses.
Yes.
All right, next question.
Dean, I think it went back to me for some reason, Dean, so I think you can go to
okay, that. Let's move on to our next question, unless you have a question, Jonathan.
Hi, this is Eric Bonnet in Indianapolis. I guess, two questions. One, first of all, the jurisdictional issue, is that general federal jurisdiction that they're talking about, or is it just the appellate jurisdiction of the courts of appeals and the Supreme Court?
The ruling, they're talking about Article III jurisdiction, but the holding in Perry is simply that the Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit mm-hmm. lack jurisdiction over the appeal. The court says nothing about whether or not the district court mm-hmm. Had jurisdiction in the first place.
Well, I mean, because the state was the defendant, was it not? So I think it would have, I mean, it could have just given, without any intervention, there would have just been a default judgment.
Correct. Although the court, there was a trial in the district court, and the district court allowed the proponents of Proposition 8 to mount a defense on behalf of the proposition in the district court. But mm-hmm. again, there are reasons to wonder why that should have been the case. There are some academics that have I think made a fairly strong argument that if there was no jurisdiction for the appeal, there should have been no jurisdiction for anything more than a default judgment at the trial court level. But the court didn't say that. It solely focused on the question of appellate jurisdiction.
And I guess the other question that occurs to me is in the litigation over how states have to treat, the states that don't recognize gay marriage have to treat the marriages in those that do. Does the lead case in that become Dred Scott? it seems a very similar situation with the, where you've got a relationship that's recognized in some states that's, other states are passing laws against.
I don't think so. I mean, the full faith and credit clause, for example, despite its language, the doctrine has historically recognized that there are instances in which states may have legitimate public policy grounds for refusing to recognize a marriage entered into another state. So I don't think you have to go back that far to find those sorts of cases. Although, after these decisions, we're going to see a lot more. Certainly, we will, I think, see challenges also to Section 2 of DOMA challenging that. But there are cases that, for example, would allow a state to refuse to recognize a marriage that it thought was immoral on some other grounds.
Jonathan, this is Dean. You're beginning to fade out.
Despite the full faith and credit clause.
Right, we've got two questions pending and just a couple minutes left. I'm going to ask the callers to be as concise as possible in their questions, and let's go to our next caller.
Joel. Yeah, this is Joel Mandelman in Washington, D.C. I apologize if I'm asking a question that came up before because I joined this late. How do you reconcile the case or controversy analysis in the federal case, in the DOMA case, with their finding no standing because there was no real controversy in California? How was there any more of a controversy in one than in the other?
It's a good question.
It's one of the mysteries of these cases.
Yeah, so, I mean, one argument, I mean, I will admit I think there was jurisdiction in both. I also, as I think I noted at the outset, Justice Alito makes the comment that the DOMA case should have been the closer call jurisdictionally, and he thought there was jurisdiction there. But if the court was only going to get rid of one, that would have been the case. But as the majority notes in Windsor, even if the federal government does not want to defend DOMA, there is a draw on the federal treasury that is at issue. And given that the federal government had said it was going to enforce DOMA, there is a practical consequence of a decision on the merits. And both the majority and Justice Alito's opinion noted the precedent of INS versus Chadha, in which the Supreme Court had allowed Congress to defend the constitutionality of a statute that the executive had refused to defend. And so I think those are the bases for finding jurisdiction in Windsor. The refusal to find jurisdiction in Perry, I do find a bit more questionable because it would seem to me that if a state recognizes a specific party or a specific group as the legitimate representative of or the legitimate party to defend a state law, that should be accepted by a federal court. But a majority concluded otherwise.
I don't know. Perry. To me, it just sounds like somebody's trying to have it both ways for bizarre and inexplicable reasons.
I'm not sure the reasons are entirely bizarre and inexplicable. They may be strategic. It's possible. I think it's also perhaps maybe the distinction would be that in the Windsor case, you have the government that, again, still had something left at stake and was at least defending technically in the case. Appealing, whereas you have no one who technically has standing. I think perhaps these people would have said that the Governor Perry had standing to appeal and just chose not to in the California District Court case. So that would be the other distinction, is you've got the third party appealing versus the aggrieved / non-aggrieved government appealing.
We've got a final caller here who's been on for some time, so let's try and squeeze in this last question if we can.
Yes, this is Deborah from Texas. If gay marriage were legalized, then wouldn't polygamy have to be? Once you begin to alter one form of traditional definition of marriage under equal protection, you can't stop at one alternative situation and then deny others.
Deborah, that's actually an issue that Justice Sotomayor brought up. She talked about polygamy and consensual adult incest and really questioned whether you could write a case that made a distinction between the two. I think the real test case would be if a state decided to make it legal to have polygamous or consensual adult incestuous relationships, and then it would be up to the federal government to decide whether they wanted to recognize them. It does seem like under this argument, if such a law seemed impending and the federal government said, well, we're going to single those out, you'd have a real problem because it would test how much they're willing to defer to the states in this marital relationships realm and how much they're really just trying to go for this one type of marriage and yet still have something in the back of their mind of what marriage means that they're willing to stick to on a federal level.
Professor Adler, a final thought?
Yeah, no, I think if a state were to recognize polygamy, then that would be a hard question for the court to deal with. I would note there is the interesting historical point, which is one of the conditions that the federal government imposed on Utah's entrance into the Union was that it prohibit polygamy. And I believe Justice Scalia points that out in his Windsor dissent.
Very good. On behalf of the Federal Society, I surely want to thank both Carrie Severino and Professor Jonathan Adler for joining us today, as we have all week long, especially on such short notice. We certainly appreciate the detail of your analysis here for us and for our members. To the audience, a reminder about our call tomorrow with Abigail Thernstrom when we'll be taking a closer look at the Shelby County Voting Rights Act case. That's tomorrow at noon Eastern Time. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.